Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, we discuss the pain of losing a child to opioid disorder and the Memorial Garden, which is opening up in Philly this week. Also, we talk Eagles, Phillies, Union, and more with Inquirer sports columnist Marcus Hayes. But first, odds are there will be a crowd of candidates vying to become Philadelphia's 100th mayor next year. And former Mayor Michael Nutter has some definite ideas regarding what he'd like to see from the next person to hold the office. Nutter served from 2008 until 2016, and in a recent opinion piece for the Philadelphia Inquirer, he encourages Philadelphians to, quote, rethink how we elect someone to one of the most powerful positions in this city. Nutter goes on to say, let's change the paradigm from who can win to who can lead, from who's the most popular to who's the most qualified to govern. We've invited Mayor Nutter to join us on the roundup to get into some of the qualities he believes will help move the city forward. And we'll get into some news of the day as well. Mayor Nutter, welcome back and nice to have you with us in studio.
Well, Mary, thank you. Always great to be at WHYY.
I should also mention that you are a professor at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs.
Yes.
So at this time, there are about, I think, a half dozen potential candidates weighing the prospect of running for Philadelphia mayor next year. And you're asking citizens to reconsider the way they think about electing a mayor. Why?
Well, I think, over time, we've allowed ourselves from time to time, election to election, to fall into what I refer to kind of watching a horse race. Who's in the lead, who has the most money, who has the most endorsements, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's certainly great fun, as a political show, but it has virtually nothing to do with actually governing, with running this city, sixth largest in the United States of America, birthplace of freedom, liberty, and democracy. We sit in the footprint of the founding of our democracy in the United States. So Philadelphia will always have a very special place, not only in America, but in the world. And so it is a complicated job. It is a big job. There is an ecosystem that, as the mayor, you have to try to manage. You have to try to be the chief coordinator, the chief convener, the chief communicator, not just for the region and 1.6 million people in Philadelphia, but 6 million or so people in the region. Millions of people across the United States of America paying attention to what happens in Philadelphia, with the largest city closest to Washington, D.C., with the second largest city on the East Coast. Yeah. New York is 70 minutes on Amtrak. So we play an outsized role. And so how do you deal with issues of public safety, education, jobs, economic sustainability, affordable housing? You have a program talking about the tragedy of the opioid crisis and so many other components. And deal with the public, deal with our great public employees, yeah. Deal with the business community, philanthropic community, the corporate community. So
It's a lot. It's a lot.
It's a big job.
And it's much more than a horse race, is what you're saying.
Much more than a horse race.
You say that being mayor is an emotional roller coaster, but it is your responsibility as mayor to give people a sense of hope. You know, it sounds as if the mayor's job can be a real test of endurance. What sort of support, including mental health care support, is available to those who hold this office?
Well, there's a physicality to being mayor. There's a spiritual component. I'm not suggesting anything with regard to religion, but, I mean, you just have to, sit with yourself from time to time, the decisions that you have to make, the lives that you will impact. There is a mental health component to it. Every day is not going to be sunshine and rainbows. Some pretty messed up things will happen from time to time, and you have to have an emotional hold on yourself and a grounding. And so, whether you seek specific mental health services or not, certainly having people around you who know you, who understand you, who can tell you right from wrong, who can lift you up when you need that lifting up. And then big part of your job is to lift them up every day. Some things will go haywire. Some things will go bad. Some things will go wrong. We made mistakes during our time. We tried to learn from them. It was not perfect.
But when the burden is crushing, I mean, for instance, you know, it's been, you know, from the murder of George Floyd and the social unrest that happened after that, the pandemic. I mean, all these things can come out of the blue. A mayor's not expecting that when he or she first takes the oath.
No, I mean,
so how what you know, do you need to think about as you're running for this job? Sure. You know, in terms of can I do this?
Yeah. Well, you know, if we were on a, you know, cable TV show, I might phrase it another way, but I'll leave it at this for WHYY. Stuff happens. Stuff happens.
Be prepared.
So, right. So, I mean, look, I ran. I wasn't supposed to win. Reformer, blah, blah, blah. You know, all that narrative. You know, great inauguration, first budget, 2008. Things were going along. We're, you know, kind of rocking and rolling. The summer of 2008, the crushing reality of the impending Great Recession was upon us. Nobody saw that coming. Nobody told me that in a briefing paper. You know, we didn't necessarily know what to do, where it was coming from, or what it was about. So I relied on many of the things I learned, you know, from the Rendell administration. When I was in city council and Ed was mayor, we had a different economic crisis, but a crisis nonetheless. And so you rely on your own instincts. You look at what others have done. I've tried to study every mayor, going back to Joe Clark and some of the things that they had to deal with, and you learn what to do, what not to do, and then hire the best people that you can and listen to them. Provide leadership, give direction, and then listen, coordinate, collaborate. It's a singular job. Leadership is a lonely position, but you're not by yourself. And that's where utilizing not only people on your team, the public servants, the public employees, but also, again, I talked about that ecosystem. The nonprofit sector, the corporate sector, the philanthropic sector, the clergy, activists, community leaders, block captains, you know, the rest of the political community. And you have to work with and deal with all of those folks.
Whoever wins the job in 2023 will have some difficult challenges to tackle already. I mean, one of which is the heartbreaking escalation in gun violence. We have a tweet from Steve who says, ask North Philly folks if they're watching a horse race. It's a life or death matter.
Every day.
So, you know, if the next mayor were to come to you for counsel on this intractable problem, you know, which steps, seemingly intractable, on which steps to take to lessen gun violence, how would you counsel them?
Well, you know, I generally don't give mayors advice in public, but, you know, I think there are some fundamentals. Obviously, set some goals, have a plan, work the plan, articulate to the public what it is that you're trying to accomplish. You're trying to make sure that people are safe. We're going to operate within the law, but people need to be safe. You can't carry guns illegally on the streets. You're going to go after the shooters. You're going to go after those who create harm and mayhem out on the streets of this city and work with. There are a lot of players, but there are four essential players in any effort to create an environment of public safety. Certainly the mayor is the leader of the city, the police commissioner who the mayor, you know, appoints, technically, the district attorney, and the courts. Now, three of those four main players are all independently elected. None can tell the other what to do. And so that's why collaboration is so critically important. I was fortunate during my time to have that, working with an experienced police commissioner like Chuck Ramsey, working with, at the time, Seth Williams, the district attorney, and knowing many of the judges. Again, we didn't tell them what we were what to do, but we certainly tried to set a tone for what we were trying to do with all this violence that was going on even during my time. And then we saw some of the results, some immediately, and then certainly in the second term, with the lowest number of homicides since 1967.
Why do you think homicides are on the rise right now? We have had, I think, 355 as of last night in Philadelphia.
I think there are a lot of reasons. You know, when we look at the impact of 2020, but even beyond, because the fact of the matter is that homicides have been on the rise for three straight years prior to the pandemic. 17 was higher than 16, 18 was higher than 17, and 19 was higher than 18. That's before any of us were talking about a pandemic. And so when you get into that kind of trend, and then the pandemic hits, it just exacerbates. It exponentially takes things to another level. People are angry. They're frustrated. They're if I can say on WHYY, really generally kind of pissed off, traumatized.
Sure.
They were, you know, we were told to both, you know, stay in the house, don't go anywhere. Kids, you know, out of school, away from their friends, away from counselors, away from social services. I mean, there was a real breakdown in all of those systems. So you already had a problem, and it just escalated during that period of time and continues, sadly. So, you know, I think that, there are a lot of things going on. It's a very complicated situation. But, you know, there are certainly a variety of steps. I think, you know, the police commissioner, Outlaw, is certainly trying to do the best that she can. She walked into a situation that was already, you know, kind of on the rise, and it's been difficult to recover. On the other hand, we see some cities across the country, as I would say Dallas in particular, Mayor Eric Johnson, you know, they saw a 12% reduction in homicides last year.
What about DA Larry Krasner? I mean, in December you responded angrily to his remarks in which he said we don't have a crisis of crime. Have you seen any walk those remarks back? He was trying, I think, to assure tourists that it was safe to visit the city. Have you seen any changes in the half year since you responded to Krasner's remarks?
Well, you know, sadly, I think this is one of those situations where, to some extent, the numbers do speak for themselves. We're on a record-breaking pace as compared to last year. Sadly, we may finish 2022 higher than we finished 2021, which was the highest in recorded history. And so, you know, the fact that people still think or feel or believe that they can carry an illegal weapon on the streets of Philadelphia and generally will not be prosecuted, it is a crime in the Pennsylvania Criminal Code, Title 18, to carry an unregistered weapon on the streets of Philadelphia, specifically on the streets of Philadelphia. So there is actually legislation that is specifically designed in the Criminal Code that is specific to the city of Philadelphia about carrying illegal weapons. My understanding is, in many instances, those that kind of crime is not necessarily being prosecuted unless a person has actually done something else. But it's actually a crime to carry that weapon on the streets if it is not registered.
So in a crisis like this, if you don't think an official, a public official, is doing their job, should they step back?
You know, that's a very personal decision for that individual to make. I generally don't give candidates or people in elective office, you know, that kind of advice. That's personal to them. I think what's more important, Mary, is that putting the various personalities aside and whether people get along or don't get along or like each other or whatever, you know, I've often said, if I only met with people I liked, I would have had a lot of free time, right? But there is a crisis in this city that requires that a level of coordination that is above and beyond personal beliefs, philosophy, or anything else. 355 dead in August is a crisis, is a tragedy, and is a disgrace to the great citizens of this city.
So the next mayor, you want to see build the team that they can work with and you know.
You have to build a team. It's all about team, and it's all about your people.
Yeah.
And any success that we had was because we had really great people who work well together.
Well, we'll have to pick up this conversation down the road. Wish we had a little more time right now. But former Mayor Michael Nutter, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Up next on the Regional Roundup, we talk about a new garden that opens up in Philly this week dedicated to people to memorialize victims of opioid overdose in the Philadelphia area. Stay tuned for more on this.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Viloma is a Sanskrit word which means against the natural order and is used to describe the parent who loses a child. The pain from such a loss is said to be indescribable to those who haven't experienced it. A lifelong grieving and even a sense of homesickness that seldom eases. Susan Osterman lost her son, Tyler Cordero, to the opioid epidemic 2 years ago. Tyler was just 24 years old. Osterman is founder of the Viloma Memorial Foundation, which has joined forces with the City of Philadelphia to open a pop-up memorial garden on Wednesday outside the city's Municipal Services Building. A virtual version of the memorial has already launched. The goal is to honor lives lost to substance use in the Philadelphia area, to create a space of hope and healing for the bereaved, and to increase public awareness around the opioid crisis. Here with us now to talk some more about this is Susan Osterman. Welcome, Susan. Susan.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. And Laura Vargas is Bereavement Care Program Manager for the Division of Substance Use Prevention and Harm Reduction at the Philadelphia Department of Public Health. Welcome to you as well, Laura.
Thank you. Good morning.
We're going to talk quite a bit about the garden in just a few minutes. But first to you, Susan, tell us about Tyler, who he was, the joy that he brought to you, and also the challenge he suffered with the opioid addiction that eventually took his life.
Tyler was a great kid. He was a percussionist. He played in the marching band in high school and the drum line. His father was also a percussionist in the Marine Corps. And he was a comedian. He definitely kept us on our toes, kept us laughing. He struggled with some anxiety through most of his life. Always had kind of a feeling where he didn't fit in socially. But he was very positive. He always remained positive. He was very forgiving and generous and kind.
Yeah. You describe the grief sometimes as this feeling of walking around feeling homesick.
Yes, that's a great description.
Tell us about the word Voloma. It's a striking word, and what you feel is the need to bring this word into our conversation?
Well, actually, the comparison with feeling homesick is a really good way to jump from there, because the only time I don't feel homesick and speaking to other Velomas is when we're together. We kind of feel normal again when we spend time together, and I think it's a lot of it because there's no expectations on us. We understand how we're all feeling, so we're kind of able to exhale. And the purpose of the gardens, not only to memorialize our loved one, is just to have a place for us to be together. You don't stop grieving your child. You're grieving 24/7. But there's expectations on you from society to go back to normal or get over it or move on. And you try, but it's an insurmountable task.
So let's talk some more about the garden, and let's bring Laura Vargas into the conversation. Laura, I hear this garden will encourage visitors to actively participate in memorializing their loved ones. Tell us more about that.
Yes, that's right. So we have a variety of opportunities. The first one, and the one that most people are familiar with going into it, is this opportunity to tag a flower. So we're going to have over 1,200, or we do, they already built it, over 1,200 flowers there to represent the 1,200 plus lives lost to substance use in the past year. However, it's not limited to those lost in the past year. So anybody that has lost a loved one to substance use in the area can come pick a flower that sticks out to them, and we'll have little labels that they can add their person's name and a little message and place that there. That's one opportunity. The other one is to make a memorial stone. We'll also have those on site that people can decorate and take with them. And then on top of those two, which will be available anytime the garden is open, we'll have plenty of activities ranging from speaker series to direct coping activities, lots of different ways to memorialize, to honor, to bring hope in that these individuals' legacies are not forgotten. You know, we will continue to say their names, share their stories, and make sure that people know how special they were. And then the other component that you briefly touched on before is the virtual memorial site.
Yeah. Yeah.
That it's live, it's open, and people can submit names, photos, stories. And it's just been really beautiful, all that we've received so far. And we're really honored to be able to display those.
And Susan, there's no pressure to do or accomplish anything if a person visits either the pop-up garden or the memorial site online. It's a judgment-free zone.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Laura, you told our producer, Paige, that many people who die from overdose have sought help. The crisis killed over 1,000 people in Philadelphia in both 2020 and 2021. Why haven't we made more headway in providing the treatment that could lead to recovery for many people?
It's really complex. There are dozens and dozens of teams and organizations in the city working on this, working to provide compassionate care, but it's something that we don't understand as well as, you know, other diseases that have decades and decades of research. So it's a matter of somebody being ready, but also for the proper care to be available, compassionate, immediate in the moment. An issue that we see a lot is people having to wait to get into treatment. And that wait time can be really detrimental because we know that addiction is a disease. We know that withdrawal is a really, really painful and difficult thing. So it's all about right place and right time and making those available for everybody when they decide that it is their time. But something that I also like to make sure people are aware of is that this isn't just impacting people with addictions. This is impacting anyone. You know, it's no longer limited to opioid epidemic, but it can be anything. So we're also really just trying to spread awareness about harm reduction, providing tools so that people know what's going on and can make informed decisions.
Where does stigma play into the research or perhaps even the lack of research into addiction and treatment? Laura, first to you.
Yeah, I think it plays on every level. You know, we don't have that many options. There's only a handful of medication-assisted treatments. There's a lot of misunderstanding. A lot of people hold this idea that it's trading one drug for another, that, you know, you're not actually coming off drugs if you're in a medication-assisted treatment program. But the science is all there to indicate that medication-assisted treatment combined with psychosocial supports is our best chance. But that stigma prevents a lot of people from seeking it out, prevents a lot of people from going into the field, and prevents a lot of research from really guiding us and providing as many opportunities and variety of medications and treatments that we have for all other diseases.
Susan Osterman, you say stigma is deeply ingrained seemingly in everybody, including yourself. In which ways?
Oh, absolutely. I think that it's one of the biggest problems is in the medical community. Like Laura was saying, access to medication-assisted treatment is huge, and it's a barrier because physicians aren't even taught very much about the disease of addiction. So they have this deep-seated moral failing in their, you know, in the back of their mind, and the readiness to help isn't there the way it needs to be. This is a public health crisis, and these people that are going into withdrawal should be treated as emergencies. This is a situation that we've got to come out from under and realize that this is not a moral failing. This is not something to do, a character flaw. This is a disease, and it needs to be treated that way. And it's in every aspect of society, law enforcement, medical care, mental health.
We have a listener email who says, judging Suboxone as part of recovery treatment is outdated and casts out people who need help the most. Susan, how did stigma affect the way, did it affect the way you related to Tyler when he was in the throes of his illness?
Absolutely. I think there were varying degrees of it throughout the 6 years that he struggled. When I sought help for him, I was told that not to enable him, you know, if he leaves, don't let him back in, things like that, where it felt wrong inside the whole time, but I still did it because I didn't know what else to do. But there came a time where I realized that was wrong, and I embraced him more, and we healed our relationship. But I think at that point, it had already gotten so deeply into him that he believed it about himself, that he wasn't worthy, that he was, you know, a failure.
You were able to come to a sort of peace between you before he passed.
We were. Thank God.
Why don't you take a moment? And I'm so sorry that we're bringing this all this emotion up for you, Susan, but so glad that you're with us to talk about this today and also to tell us about the garden. I'm going to go to Laura for just a moment. You know, walk through the city, and it's easy to come upon someone who might be suffering from opioid or substance use disorder. You know, Laura, the natural inclination for many of us, it's just to give that person a wide berth. How should we view them? How should we treat them?
These individuals are somebody's child, sibling, significant other, parent, treating them like a human. That we lose that so often when you just look away, when people feel uncomfortable or afraid or like they're in danger, when that's really not the case. These are individuals that have fallen on tough times and are struggling and need all the support. We hear these stories about somebody treating them like a human and engaging them in a conversation and the impact that that has. Our garden engagement staff, we've been getting to know one another for the past week, and they've been wonderful. And many of them had been working in outreach and have spoken about their experiences connecting with somebody, really just being one-to-one with them, no power dynamic or no looking at them any differently. And then hearing from that person or seeing that person again in a few weeks and being told how impactful it was just to have spent a few minutes getting to know each other, sharing names and stories and whatnot. So you'd be surprised the impact that something that seems so simple can have, just because so many are so dehumanized by people because of stigma. And that is incredibly detrimental. Like Susan mentioned, you know, some people start to internalize this when you're just treated like you're less than or like you don't belong, you don't deserve this. That's not helping anyone. There's no good that can come out of that.
We're now seeing multi-million and billion-dollar settlements from pharmaceutical firms. Endo's the latest with $450 million, I think, to go to our area. Laura, where should that money go first, in your opinion? And are we starting to see any trickle-down to agencies which are boots on the ground?
So I'm not entirely sure. That's not, you know, something that I'm super involved in. I do have a lot of thoughts. You know, I think on harm reduction is the biggest thing, being able to meet people where they're at, offering all sorts of opportunities without being tied to something. Something that my team, and we're bereavement support, we do grief counseling and peer support groups and whatnot. Something that we hear a lot from people is an interest in counseling, but not having it tied to a daily treatment program. You know, a lot of the things that we provide people, we link it in with something else that kind of feels coercive, if you will. So I think that really using that funding to make things accessible, to remove the stigma and just offering support in a way that's accessible and that people have the autonomy to decide what they do. I think another thing that's super important and kind of where I've really focused my energy on is on pushing for bereavement support. Yeah. So our program, it's the only one of its kind in the nation. There's nothing that's tied to a health department, direct bereavement support for free, specific to substance use, that is super accessible. So I think that that's something really important, because these funds, you know, they're being spread all over the place, and it's wonderful to have that money coming in and to have those opportunities. But no one seems to be talking about, what about the people that were already impacted, the ones whose lives were already devastated by this crisis? We know that mental health is really expensive and there's a shortage and really hard to come by. So if other places can use funding to offer similar programs, we've seen the success that we've had. And we've heard from people that want this all over the place. We got contacted from people out of state that unfortunately we can't serve if it didn't come through Philadelphia. But that shows us a need for more programs all over the place. I think that bereavement support for those who have lost someone, and also tons and tons of harm reduction.
Susan, parents, many parents, you know, they are bereaved and they also feel shame around addiction. They don't want to disclose it, perhaps the cause of their child's death to others. How would you counsel these parents if you were to speak with them?
That breaks my heart. It honestly does, because just navigating this grief alone is so difficult. I can't imagine having to keep up something that isn't accurate. And I would tell them to be proud of their child, embrace them, and speak about them without shame. They deserve that. And they deserve that as parents. You know, you didn't do anything wrong. Everybody wants to say, oh, I was a bad parent, or I did something wrong. It was nothing you could control. We all loved our children. We all love our children.
And I understand, Susan, you want this garden to be an outlet to allow parents to be proud of their children.
Absolutely, yes. This needs to be a place where we honor them and speak about them proudly and all of their shining good ways, because they all had them.
If you were able to wave a magic wand, Susan, and change treatment programs for the better for people struggling with substance use, what would you do? How would you affect change?
I think that the most important thing, like Laura said, is immediate access to treatment. When someone's ready, they need to be able to access it immediately. But I think that the focus needs to be more on autonomy. Excuse me. People aren't able to find their purpose in this life. They need to be able to have all of their basic needs taken care of so they could focus on what they truly want to do. I think so many struggle with just trying to, you know, make ends meet or take care of their families. They don't have that freedom to do that. And I think that a lot of people are missing that, especially when you start using young.
Yeah. Laura, looking at the calendar again, you know, the garden, the Memorial Garden, will offer all sorts of services. It opens up on Wednesday in Philadelphia, right at the Municipal Services Building. The services range from Narcan training to community art. And I'm even seeing a little bit of humor, a Hot Widows Cafe on the 18th. Can humor help to heal?
Absolutely. You know, we have a lot of dark humor in our support groups, and it just brings people together. You know, when you feel heard and understood, you can connect with others. But when you go through the world being expected to show up in a certain way, that's not very welcoming.
Yeah. Susan, we only have about 20 seconds left. What would you like to add as we close our conversation?
Actually, I would like to address the opioid settlement funds. Okay. And just remind people that we need to do something different with that money. The things we're doing isn't working. It hasn't worked, or the numbers would be going down. Please consider thinking out of the box.
All right. Susan Osterman, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Susan is founder of the Veloma Memorial Foundation. Pop-up garden again opens on Wednesday in Philadelphia. And Laura Vargas, bereavement care program manager for the Division of Substance Use Prevention and Harm Reduction in the Philly Department of Health, thanks to you as well.
Thank you so much.
All right, take care. Up next, we talk sports. Stay close.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. With Eagles preseason in the rearview mirror and the start of the regular season less than 2 weeks away, we thought we'd take a little time today to talk about what we can expect from the 2022 campaign, which begins Sunday, September 11th, Eagles at Detroit. Also, the Phillies are on a tear, swept the Reds last week, and took 2 out of 3 from the Pirates. Inquirer sports columnist Marcus Hayes says the Phils are primed for a late-season run. It's been over a decade since they played October ball, so there is excitement around the Fightins for sure. And the boys in blue are sitting atop the MLS Eastern Conference, the Union getting the job done. Lots to talk about. Marcus Hayes joins us once again on the Roundup. Welcome back, Marcus.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, great to have you back with us. Birds were thumped by Miami Saturday night, 48-10 in preseason play, though most of their starters walked the sideline, Marcus, while the Dolphins played a bunch of theirs perhaps perilously close to the start of the season. So overall, what did you take from all three preseason games?
Well, I mean, one of the interesting things about how preseason goes now is that coaches tend to put a disproportionate amount of importance on team versus team practices.
Yeah.
Now, the Dolphins lost one of those two practices against the Eagles because they had an outbreak of a stomach flu. I think it was a stomach flu. And, you know, so they decided to play their starters a little bit more. Any more, you don't really know what you have going in because you don't know how coaches grade practices. And they seem to grade practices more weight than they grade the actual preseason games because so few starters play in those games, and if they do play, they don't play very much. So the long-winded answer to your question is I don't know what we're going to see in Detroit on September 11th because they really haven't played any football.
Okay. So, you can't really give us a sense of how the offense or the defense looks.
You know, on paper, both sides should be more dynamic. But, you know, the two big things that people haven't really, I think, given enough weight is an offensive line works best when it works together and seamlessly. The best offensive lineman over the last few years has been Jason Kelce, their center, who's missed the entire preseason, the entire training camp with elbow surgery. He might not even be back until game two. So that offensive line, which is their best unit, might not be very good. Now, the thing that really has kind of gone under the radar is Javon Hargrave, their defensive tackle, who went to the Pro Bowl last year, has been out with a toe injury. Again, you know, you're talking chemistry, and you know, usually it's like a 7 to 9 man rotation on the defensive line. So those are the two things that are alarming to me and could come back to bite them, even in Detroit, which was arguably, you know, over the last 3 or 4 years, one of the worst teams in football history.
Okay. Well, let's get to the quarterback, which we love to talk about quarterbacks here in the roundup. Jalen Hurts, 6'1", as you write. He doesn't have the size advantage of other star quarterbacks nor the arm strength. But if he can improve on processing stuff, as he puts it, you say Hurts has a shot.
You know, last year, I believe it was against the Jets. It might have been the Giants. He put together a show of why the Eagles considered him a real starting prospect. And he did it in the first came back from an ankle injury. So he wasn't nearly as mobile as he normally is. And he's very mobile. He's a great runner. When that was taken away from him, he ran the offense as it was presented in front of him and made great decisions. And I compared him in that game to Steve Young, mm-hmm. also incredibly mobile, also not gifted with great arm strength, but really, really smart. Jalen Hurts is a smart quarterback who I don't think takes advantage of his intelligence and his instinct as much as he should. If he tries to do less, he might be able to do more.
All right. Well, to the backups, just in case, heaven forbid, Hurts is injured. Gardner Minshew, how'd he look?
He looked better as the preseason progressed. But again, we have to understand that most of the offensive linemen who would be blocking for him in a game, and these offensive linemen are probably the best unit in the league, weren't blocking for him in the preseason.
Sure.
The Gardner Minshew, I think, could take this team right now to the playoffs. Gardner Minshew is a good quarterback. He might be a better, you know, classic quarterback than Jalen Hurts right now, though Jalen Hurts probably has a much higher ceiling.
Okay. And do we need somebody in the number three spot, I should say? I mean, I was hearing that Reed Sinnott didn't look so hot out in the field.
He didn't. And, you know, my hope has always been that we could get another Carson on the roster, Carson Strong as the third quarterback, because, you know, football just doesn't seem right without a Carson on the roster, right?
All right. It'll be interesting. Speaking of Carson's, come November, I think, right? When we first see him.
That's right.
Carson Wentz?
Yeah,
okay.
Carson Wentz. But actually, I my assignment for the opening weekend is to go to Washington for Carson Wentz's season opener, his debut as the Commanders quarterback against the Indianapolis Colts and Frank Reich, who were his team last year. And Frank Reich, who sort of insisted that the Eagles number one, when he was the offensive coordinator in 2016 and 17, insisted they draft Carson Wentz over Jared Goff and insisted that Carson Wentz was ready to start as a rookie and help facilitate the trade of Sam Bradford to Minnesota and gets Carson Wentz's career off to a rousing start. So I'm looking forward to I'm looking forward to Indianapolis versus Washington much more so than I am Philadelphia, Detroit.
And we're looking forward to your article as soon as it's published. So, all right. So final cuts happen tomorrow, Marcus. Anyone on the bubble who shouldn't be?
You know, the big one is going to be whether Jalen Reagor, who was a first-round draft pick 2 years ago, is cut or traded or remains on the roster. I would keep him on the roster. I think he has talent. But, you know, he was unfortunate on a couple of different levels as a wide receiver. The biggest issue was a more polished wide receiver than he, Justin Jefferson, was taken immediately after him and has been the best young wide receiver in the history of football. So he has that sort of chip on his shoulder and that sort of burden to bear. And he didn't draft himself. He also wasn't ready for training camp when he came in as a rookie, and he suffered a few tragedies that have been distracting him over the past two seasons. So that'll probably be the big biggest question to be answered by tomorrow at 4 o'clock.
Okay. Well, by the way, before we get on to the Phillies, can you believe it's been 5 years since the 2017 season, you know, which ended with Super Bowl 52? I mean, I can't believe the time's flown that quickly.
Because I'm so close to it, it seems like it's been 10 years. It's just dragged and dragged. I've seen so much bad football, so many bad decisions, so much hubris from the front office, so much humility that should have been shown and wasn't from Howie Roseman, the general manager, and Jeffrey Lurie, the president, and correction. You know, they understood their mistakes, and they're trying to correct these mistakes. And, you know, I saw the disintegration of Carson Wentz from this fine, upstanding young man to this incredibly arrogant, dismissive, selfish person. So for me, it's been a long, you know, a long slog. It seems like it was 10 years ago. I got to tell you, it seems like it's been as long since the Phillies were in the playoffs, and that was 11 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, those two things in my rearview mirrors look about the same.
Yeah. Well, one more question about the Eagles. I mean, as far as this particular Eagles squad, do they get back to the playoffs under Nick Sirianni as head coach?
Absolutely. Okay. I mean, they're as you know, the biggest issue for them might be Carson Wentz. If Carson Wentz plays as well as he did before he got COVID in Indianapolis last year, the Washington Commanders could be a pretty good team. It looks like Dallas's injury issues are going to hamstring them. Tyron Smith kind of had a terrible hamstring injury. He's their best offensive lineman. You know, their running back situation isn't great, and they lost Amari Cooper to a trade. Washington could win this division if Carson Wentz plays as well as Carson Wentz can. Absolutely. You know, and it's not a good division. You know, the Eagles aren't great. The Cowboys aren't great. So it's not like the Washington Commanders are going to make it to the NFC Championship game. But the division the NFC should be better than last year. And a lot of it depends on Carson Wentz, who you can argue is the most talented quarterback in the NFC East again.
Interesting. Right. Well, we meet Carson and company twice, you know, in the coming
right,
mark.
Yeah.
So it certainly shall be fun. All right. So let's get to the Phillies firmly in the wild card. I can't speak this morning, Marcus. I'm having a hard time, but I think people know what we're talking about. They're doing pretty well
Monday
in the wild card hunt. It's like, yes.
That's right.
Anyway, you say, Marcus, they are primed for a late season run. They've had a really good week and a half or so here. So tell us more about that. Why do you think they might actually end up in the postseason for the first time in over a decade?
Yeah, I wrote that column coming out of a very depressing Mets series where they seemed to do everything they could to prove Keith Hernandez right over a 10-day period. Keith Hernandez, former Met, sort of dismissed the Phillies as kind of a joke organization, that he wouldn't even come and do the games. He was just like, you know what, I asked for time off during the Philly series because over the years I just can't watch baseball played this badly at this level.
Yeah.
Which, in his defense, you know, the last time he saw them, which was about, you know, a few weeks before that, they were playing poorly and had played poorly for a long time. It was a horrible thing to say. I hope it haunts him forever. But they've been playing great against good teams. So we exit that weekend thinking, okay, maybe the Phillies aren't very good. And then they go 6-1. What they're doing is they're beating the team they're supposed to beat. And that's what good teams do. You know, I think they're 32-6 against the worst teams that they've faced. And they came out of the Mets series with 22 games against sub-500 teams, 22 games in a row against sub-500 teams. And they started 6-1. So they're going to, I believe it's Arizona, they'll be in Arizona tonight. 15 games against teams below 500, and they've, as I said, they've taken care of these sorts of teams. And if you're a Phillies fan or a Phillies reporter, you know that even in their best years, they often had trouble beating the bad teams.
Yeah.
They would play the really good teams 500, the pretty good teams they would beat, and then the terrible teams they would play down to their level.
The Marlins for many years. Yeah, it was so frustrating.
The Marlins, especially and the Nationals, who they saw 19 times, they would go 500 or worse against them constantly and befuddling. You just couldn't understand it.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
that's who they were, but they don't seem to be that anymore, perhaps because of Rob Thompson, perhaps the new manager makes them understand that even these games are, this game is as important against the game against the Braves or the Mets.
The interim manager, and we're all thinking he probably, or many of us are thinking he probably, you know, really deserves to just be manager, you know, that doesn't come for a while, I guess.
No, there's a process in baseball, you know, for equal hiring processes that keeps teams from just appointing, which is, you know, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. I mean, I'm sure that Phillies fans, if Rob Thompson gets them to the NLCS, will be, you know, mortified if, you know, somebody comes swoops in with a gigantic offer for a guy who's really only managed, you know, two-thirds of a season. But, you know, stranger things have happened. I mean, they made Gabe Kapler a manager with no experience, and Aaron Boone's been the manager in New York and hasn't done anything, you know, and had no managerial experience. So, yeah, Rob's the right guy for the right job at the right time.
If they manage to, if they do get into the playoffs and they make any headway, they're going to have to play, you know, really good teams. And the Mets have been, you know, their kryptonite thus far. I mean, Bryce Harper's back. If he and Kyle Schwarber were in the lineup in their series against the Mets earlier this month, I mean, the Phils won 2 out of 7. A couple of those losses were pretty close. Might they have done better?
They might have been a little bit better. But the difference between the Phillies and the Mets is more than just, you know, the 50 home runs you're going to get from those guys. It's, as Keith Hernandez noted, even though the Mets have more errors than the Phillies, they make more plays than the Phillies. They do less dumb stuff than the Phillies have done on the base paths and in the field. They are spectacularly good at grinding out at bats, you know, getting to two strikes and then putting the ball in play. And, you know, with Jacob deGrom and Max Scherzer at the front of their rotation, you know, it's better than Zach Wheeler and Aaron Nola. And Zach Wheeler's hurt right now. Yeah. So all that said, the Mets are a better team. And they're a really good team. And they're a fun team to watch. You know, I'm not from Philadelphia. I'm from New York State. I was never a Mets fan. But they're a fun team to watch. And I know that's heresy to say in Philadelphia. But they're a good baseball team. And the Phillies are a pretty good baseball team. And honestly, we shouldn't ask for much more than that, considering the issues the Phillies have had over the last decade.
Yeah, let's get to the playoffs, right? Let's just get there.
That's right.
All right. So pitcher Kyle Gibson has never started a playoff game. If the Phillies do end up playing postseason ball and Zach Wheeler is off the injured list, does Gibson get his chance?
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
If Wheeler is off the injured list, yeah.
He is pitching great. He really is. It's like he can smell the water. He's a cow or a horse, and he hasn't had a drink for a long time. He could smell the water over the ridge, and he's making this wonderful charge. Kyle Gibson is pitching beautifully, and that may marginalize Ranger Suarez, who also is pitching beautifully and is left-handed.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're in pretty good shape as far as their starters go, assuming that Wheeler comes off the injured list. I think it's next Tuesday, and I think this might be something he could pitch through if it were the postseason. Zach Wheeler, who's like the Cy Young runner up for the last 2 years, he's a really, really great pitcher. He's probably the best pitcher they've had here since Roy Halladay.
Mm.
So
wow.
You know, it's a big deal. Yes, but again, the Kyle Gibson and the Gene Segura. Gene Segura is the longest tenured player in the majors who hasn't been to the playoffs.
Wow.
And I've covered every minute of Gene Segura's tenure here in Philadelphia. I have never seen him this focused. I've never seen him this fit. I've never seen him this professional. He understands that this might be his last best chance because he could be a free agent next year.
Well, and let's hope he gets a taste of October baseball then. Yeah. So anyway, one more quick question for you, Marcus. I'm completely, you know, out away from the Phillies and the Eagles. WNBA is expanding. Phillies under consideration along with some other cities. Just your take. Do you think Philadelphia might be a good fit for a WNBA expansion team? And we've got about 20 seconds.
As the husband of a former Division I college basketball player and the father of three very good youth basketball players who takes them to see WNBA games, it would be a spectacular fit, and it's long overdue.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll see. We'll see what happens. Marcus, appreciate the insight as always. Thanks so much. And we will be checking in again.
Please. Thank you.
All right. Marcus Hayes writes about sports for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Don't forget, you can find today's show at WHYY.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez is our engineer, our producer, Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for joining us. Be well.